Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. Today is February 21st, 2013, and my main science topic tonight I will be talking about, this covers many fields, chemistry, biology, luminosity of LEDs, the little lights that we buy. They're very powerful. They take very little energy. It's called luminosity. That's going to be my main science topic tonight. And it just so happens we have a comet coming into the solar system right now, Comet C 2012 F6. And Lemon is an additional name there. It's found by the Lemon is a automated search program, I believe, at the University of Arizona. But at any rate, this comet is lighting up like a light bulb. So I wanted to explain the concept of luminosity and what it means in a comet. And I find it rather comical. The standard scientific community is rather dancing around this topic. I just was looking at some postings on the internet. Previously, they had been saying this was reflected light. Now, I kind of slammed this on my show. Was it last week or the week before? And I said, how absurd. I said, if you asked a chemist what and we did a Gedanken experiment where you take a clear glass tube, and you shine a light through that, or some kind of excitation process. And luminosity is the process by which we, for example, light up a neon light bulb. That's the same process. You take an energy source. It could be light. It could be electricity, electrons passing through the neon tube. And in fact, that's the most, that's the process that is most similar, that is most likened to a comet, because you have the electrical discharge, the primarily electrons passing from the sun through. And by the way, if you have a neon light bulb, there are two currents in that light bulb. There's a positive current from the positively charged ions that moves in one direction, and you have the electrons which pass in the other direction. But it's primarily the electrons which are the excitation vehicle, because they move the fastest. They are the bulk of the charge movement or the current movement in that tube. And it's exactly the same way in a comet. Anyway, okay, I'll go into that topic tonight. We also have some potential solar flare conditions coming up. There's some magnetic conditions on the sun. There's a solar spot, a sunspot called AR1678, 1678, which has potential for Earth-directed solar flares. And the statistics that I've seen, the people who do these estimates, put it at around 45% chance of an M flare, which is a pretty good flare, or 15% chance of an X-class flare. And so anyway, that going on right now. And by the way, just minutes before the show started, I'm sitting here miking up and getting ready. I got a call from producer Tom Danheiser from Coast to Coast, so I will be on first hour tonight, Coast to Coast AM, with host George Norrie, and talking about solar conditions, exactly those conditions. But for the people who listen to this show, get a little pre-announcement on that. And this, it doesn't mean that we will definitely have a flare. It's just a possibility that we could have a flare. And will that be Earth-directed? Nobody can predict that. The thing is, sometimes scientists say, well, this sunspot is directed directly at Earth. But that's rather a misnomer, because a lot of times the solar flares, when they come blasting out of the sun, they come out at an angle, sometimes quite an askew angle, So it's really difficult to tell where a flare might go before it is activated, before it's actually activated off the surface of the sun. So at any rate, time will tell. But once again, we have a very minimal solar cycle. It's very weak, and I was just looking at some video clips of the previous solar cycle, and just booming, constantly booming, giant booming flares coming off the sun hourly for days and weeks. And we have not seen that. We just have not seen that kind of activity from the sun during this solar cycle. So in general, we're seeing a very, very weak solar cycle. And once again, I will repeat this because I think it's important. Spaceweather.com repeatedly, and once again today, showing auroras, talking about the very active aurora season, which is really a misnomer because we are in a very weak solar cycle. They're showing auroras around the North Polar region, which are always there, 365 days a year. That little auroral ring is up by the North Pole, so it's not a big deal. In fact, there's a guy, and I think he was a farmer, kind of an active watcher of the sky, so to speak, and he lived in North Dakota. And, of course, there's dark skies up there. And he said, literally, for every night it was clear and he had visibility, he could look north. And literally every clear night he saw auroras. And so what he was seeing is the auroras that are around the North Pole. Enough of that would bleed southwards in the atmosphere where he would actually be able to see that. So, but at any rate, we're looking at the potential here for some X-class flares. Today, I was a guest on Dr. Bill Deagle's show, and we were talking about exactly this topic, solar flaring, the potential for solar flares to damage Earth. And I made something clear, and the reason we were talking about this is because there's the United Nations. I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The United Nations has taken up the banner somehow to, and I don't know what they think they're going to do if there's a massive power outage, but somehow the UN wants to become a part of the control mechanism for the world if there's a massive power outage due to solar flaring. And so, I made the point today that if we are hit by a solar flare, if it's a big one, even if it's a medium-sized flare, and if it had the potential and, in fact, carried through and took down the power grid, first of all, it would not do it on a worldwide scale. Second of all, the region that it hit, say the United States, the most industrialized, electrically powered nation in the world, say the United States was directed at the sun when that solar flare hit, came out through the carried out through the magnetic field of the sun and hit Earth and did damage to the solar grid, it would not take down all of the grid. It would never take down 100% of the grid. A lot of the grid would hobble through. There might be partial damage in some regions. In some regions would make it through just fine. I recall a power outage back in, about 1997, 98, somewhere in that time frame. There was a massive power outage that started in, of all places, Roswell, New Mexico, in the States, once the power outages started tripping, that went all the way up to Vancouver. So we had a block of states, maybe a dozen states in the western United States that were down, that took a full power outage and took the entire state down, the grid of these dozen states. But still, there was power in the rest of the country. And so here is my point, that I have said all along that the people that run the world, kind of that group of 500 to 1,000 people who control tier one science, who own the tier one scientists, black ops, the banks, the world governments, the banking system of the world, the psycho controllers of the world, so to speak, they have to understand what I'm telling you, that a naturally occurring power grid outage due to a solar flare would not take down the whole world. In fact, most of the world would survive. A lot of the world, I shouldn't say most, I'd say in an extremely severe solar flare that affected the solar grid or the electric grid, much of the world would survive. It's just like any other kind of bombing technique or any other type of, say, military technique. You're not going to take everything down. And this is why I have said that there's going to be a false flag solar event. A false flag solar event by which we get hit with a significant flare that would normally do damage to the whole, to the power grid. But they're going to pull the lever and pull the power grid all over the world. And that's why when the UN got involved, that's when I said, uh-oh, this is becoming a worldwide issue. Because a long time ago, I started seeing this when NASA was making all these foreboding promises or predictions about how drastic the power outages could be. And yes, they could be severe. But what they fail to say is it would not be universal. It would not be every place on the planet Earth. And a lot of places would make it through without a lot of damage. There would be a lot of damage. But still, there would be some areas that would survive. So the people in charge understanding this know that they're going to have to pull a false flag power grid outage in which everything goes down all around the world. And when you see that, you're going to know that this was not due to a naturally occurring solar flare. It was done at the bequest of the powers, the controllers of the world. And I also made the point that they need power. They're going to need power in certain regions, say to move military, to gas up the military vehicles that are moving across the country during a martial law operation. They're not going to be able to simply depend on reserve power from here and there and other places that they might have set up. They're going to have to selectively turn that power grid on to move, to do things necessary for their ongoing control. And so this is the same as any kind of terrorist event. They have to control both sides. So Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, the Taliban. Remember all of the boogeymen that come out? These are all CIA-constructed groups and people. These are all people that came out of training camps of the CIA, the police force of the world bankers. And so what I'm telling you is that if they decide to pull the power grid, they're going to have to do it manually to make sure it all goes down, because a selective natural event would not cause the whole power grid to go down. And they need the entire thing to go down. They don't want little pockets here and there of people who are able to maintain. So, okay, enough of that, but that's where I see this going. Just a quick mention, and by the way, these are fairly complex topics, interaction between science, engineering, and politics. So that's why I know a lot of people listen to this show, because you ain't going to hear this on the evening news with Dan Rather, I guarantee you. Well, Dan isn't with us anymore, but with whoever happens to be out there on the evening news these days, whatever pretty face they put up there, you're not going to hear this on the evening news or read it on CNN or spaceweather.com or any other government mouthpiece out there. Just a quick notice here. This came across my desk this week, and I actually saw proof of this. Under Obamacare, and you can check this out if you know any business owners, especially big business owners, the companies are just squealing pig happy about dumping their health care programs in getting the people off of the corporate-sponsored healthcare programs, which has been the backbone of the American workforce, the ability to have healthcare at the workplace, and some people have to pay some for it, but really the cost is pretty minimal compared to what you would have to pay if you went out and tried to buy your own insurance. So the healthcare benefit as an employee has been a huge benefit, and now the, like I say, the corporations are squealing pig happy to get to dump this and to get the people onto Obamacare. And what happens to the people? Well, they, of course, have all of their records confiscated and dumped into government data banks. In other words, the government now controls your health care, which basically is your body. But here's the part I didn't realize, that the businesses not only get to dump the employees, get rid of them, save that big chunk of money that they were dumping into employee health care, but they get reimbursed. They get reimbursed for back expenses if they dump their employees onto Obamacare. So that's a huge incentive. And like I say, these greedy companies would do it for a nickel, let alone some good reimbursement. So this just shows you what they'll go to. And then who pays the bill for this? Well, it's the poor people who get dumped onto this system who are going to end up paying directly into the pockets of corporations reimbursement for money already spent on health care for you, the worker. Oh, I'll tell you, where do these people come up with this? They have rooms full of people just sitting there trying to figure out how they can basically rape the public, put them in a box and spit them out. This is unbelievable. I just want to mention something. We all know about the meteor that hit Russia, the meteorite that came in and exploded in the air before it hit, injuring about 1,000 people. And I've heard varying reports on the number of injuries, etc. But the reality is that this object, well, it came in the same day, February 15th, the same day as the passage of the DA-14 asteroid that came by Earth. And the thing is that the meteorite that came in and hit Russia in the middle of a metropolitan area came in at really a low velocity, a very low velocity relative to what objects should be moving out in outer space. Just random items moving around out there. It was actually moving quite slowly, which brings up the possibility that it was man-made. It was a man-diverted object or something. It wasn't very big. It was about the size of your breakfast table. That's about how big this object was. And, of course, coming in at high speed, it's going to cause some damage. It exploded above the ground in a brilliant explosion, and then proceeded to come down in many pieces. But I just wanted to throw that out there, that it just seemed very strange to me how slow this thing was moving. And, of course, in our reference frame, as far as Earthlings, it was moving very fast, an object from outer space. But in terms of outer space objects, this object was moving very slow, which, like I said, tipped me off to the potential. I'm not saying it was, because there's no way to prove this. How can you go back and track that? But I also find it's interesting that NASA, through its outreach little mouthpiece, some of its outreach little mouthpieces, announced that they have the ability to move objects in outer space, and supposedly to save Earth, but they could, that also means they have the ability to move them to hit Earth. So I just find that interesting as a twist on our illustrious space agency. Could that have been something to, and you have to understand too, the amount of effort being put into false information regarding asteroids colliding with Earth or meteorites coming into Earth as a diversion so the public doesn't think about comets. The idea that things have to hit Earth to do damage, and of course that's something I've promoted all along, is action at a distance. It's a term I coined back in my very early days of dealing with the comet issues, that these, the big comets, the big ones, don't have to hit us. In fact, hitting the Earth is very rare. It's a pretty small speck of dust out there in the middle of space. But big things coming by have a much bigger window, so to speak, of opportunity to do damage just by coming close to Earth. Once again, I want to let people know that my new book release is in pre-release right now, and many people are taking advantage of the pre-release offer, and I do this for a number of reasons. Because my book releases have always been very tightly held, very tightly guarded, and I have my own mechanisms for maintaining privacy, so to speak, before they're being released. In fact, I'm right now in setting up the date for the actual release show of that book. So I'll be announcing that that date and time of the radio show where the actual book will be released with the title. Prior to that, nobody but nobody has visibility of what this new book is about. But at any rate, I'll just give you a few hints. It's in ebook format only. It's 40 chapters long, and I consider it a monumental work on a particular topic. It's something that is a beautiful addition to my current set of books, and I'll just give you another hint. It's in the realm of space science, and I'll just also insert a short note here that I have two books coming out, but I wanted to release them in order. The second book will be out, give the first book time to run a bit, but the second book is going to be on a different topic, something kind of, I'll give you more details on that a bit later. But for a couple months, I've been somewhat invisible, and that's because I have to just get away from everything. I've got to get away from the ringing phone and all of the other things. I have to just get away so I can bury my nose and mind into some work. And so anyway, this new book is a result of that. But, here's how the pre-release is working. The new book, once it's released, will cost $17.95. That's in ebook format, only ebook format. But before, in the pre-release state, you can get it in two ways. You can either buy it as a pre-release for $12, which is a pretty good deal. And then, when about an hour before the release program, you'll get an email, and it'll give you the place to go and download the book, and it's with the download information. And so that's the benefit of buying it in pre-release. And the other people that wait, and they'll be paying $17.95, and they won't be able to get it until after the release show. The other way you can get it is all five of my books now, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection, the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, and the Diamond Principle are all in ebook format. So as a set, those five books that are already out there, the five-book set is $65 in ebook format. So if you buy that package, then you will get the new book free. And so that's a pretty good deal. So that's the whole purpose of the pre-release, is to give people an opportunity to set up. And in both cases, with the five-book set, of course, you download that right away. But the free book, the new book that you get with the that purchase of the five books, the same thing will happen as if you purchase it for $12. About an hour before the release program, you will get an email using the same email you used to make the order, and you will receive an email giving you the location to go and download the new book. And I think people are going to really, really, really like this. The beauty of ebooks now is that this one is going to be very colorful. Let me put it that way. A lot of pictures with a lot of explanation, and that's the beauty of the ebook, is that to print a book like this would cost a fortune. And it would to print would cost a fortune, and to purchase would cost a fortune. In ebook format, you can do it for, like I say, $17.95, and so that's a huge, huge advantage. Okay, so let me just look through my other topics here. The router bug, I talked about that a few weeks ago, and I got a lot of emails from people giving me different information, but it turns out that they have done studies. People who produce routers, the manufacturers of routers, have gone out there and scoured their equipment. Around 90%, that's 90% of all Wi-Fi routers on this planet have that bug. Now, gee, wonder where that comes from. There's a couple other quick topics before I get into the main science topic. This was sent in by a listener, and I'm just going to read through this list. It's very, somebody went through some time here to create this list, and so I thank the listener who took the time to write this list. But it says, Nibiru's many names. In other words, this is a list, and let me see how long it is. There are 87 different names for Nibiru, and these come from ancient, from translated names, etc. So I'm going to quick read through this list. I don't know if I'll get through all 80 of these, but I think you'll get the impression or get the gist of what's going on here. These are the many names of Nibiru, in other words, Planet X, etc. Okay, so I'm just going to start reading on the list, and so I thank the listener who sent this in. Okay, here are the names, the many names of Nibiru. The Deathwings, Nemesis, Nibiru, Eris, Planet X, Wormwood, The Destroyer, The Red Dragon, Sky Dragon, Gabriel's Fist, Brown Dwarf, Black Sun, Dark Star, The Destroyer Star, Sackcloth, Herculubus, Black Rain, Black Hole, Dragon, Lucifer, Devil, Phaeton, El Diablo, Tish, The Red Planet, The Dragon's Tail, The Crossing Planet, Winged Orb, Opophis, The Death Star, The Red Kachina, Marduk, The Ottawa Object, Vulcan, Trans-Pluto, The Winged Globe, Xena, The Perpetrator, The Red Devil Planet, The Red Comet, The Tenth Planet, The Purifier, The Frightener, The Feathered Serpent, The Horned One, The Dome Shape, The Doom Shape, Binary Little Brother, Crimson Rider, Twelfth Planet, what's this one here? Netero, Kolob, Orcus, Lumi, Hades, Rasha Sun, Great Star, Tycho, Barnard, Typhon, Abaddon, Abydos, Horrible Star, Great Red Dragon, The Horned Sun, Dark Companion, Dark Twin, Winged Disc, Demon Star, Red Card. Let me, it goes on. Here's one, Quetzalcoatl. I wanted to make sure I listed that one. That's one of my personal favorites. The Unmasked Kachina, Treta Yuga, Kua Yuga, The Fiery Messenger, The Unknown Planet, Bearded Star, Fiery Dragon, Anu, etc. So I read most of the 81 there. I think you get the idea that there are many names for this object that come through to us through history from all around the world. The bearded star, I don't know if that was in the list, but all of the various names that come out of mythology. And so anyway, thank the listener who sent that in. Here's an article that I found in Physics Today. This is a magazine that comes from American Physical Physics Society, I believe. And at any rate, it deals with a concept of taking boats, basically, in big, giant tubes and spraying seawater into the air. And the concept is that you would create clouds which would dim the sun and cause cooling of the earth because we're heading into global warming. And so what I wanted to mention is that this is another kind of mega project based on bad tier two science. The world is experiencing global warming, but they're talking about failure to reach a global agreement to achieve meaningful emission reduction, talking about global warming as a cause fails to limit greenhouse gases. So once again, trying to use bad science to develop a mega project which is not going to do anything. It's not going to solve our problems. And the it makes many good points. As far as data is concerned, in 2012, the Arctic polar cap is 50% of what it was only about 5 or 6 years ago, since the data started being taken in 1979, as far as satellite imagery of the northern polar cap. And, of course, it is down. I'm not saying it's not. But the cause is that, and they also make the point that as it melts, the seawater absorbs a very high percentage of something like 90%, 93%, they say, of the sunlight striking it is absorbed by the seawater. With the cap of ice, about 90% of the light from the sun is reflected. And so clearly, as more and more of the sea ice melts and goes away, more and more heat is absorbed, and this is going to cause a change in climate, that cycle that's controlled by the northern polar cap. But the real cause here is that we are coming out of an ice age. What caused that ice age? Well, standard science denies the whole concept that we went into an ice age. Why? Because we went through the tail of a large comet. The Earth was plunged into an ice age. We had our poles shifted. In the last 10,000 years, there were some major events. The Noah's Flood. We went through a comet tail for 40 days and 40 nights. And so that blotted out the sun, a lot of the earth. This water turned into glaciation. The sea levels rose. The atmosphere changed. And then thousands of years later, after the Noah's Flood, we had the Venus event, a totally separate event where we interacted with a comet. And there were many effects at that point. That comet came much closer. There were mountain building events. That's the Quetzalcoatl of the Mayans. We know that the tidal waves came across the land, killing most of the people. So at any rate, the point is that modern science denies those events, the most formative events in the history of mankind in recent history in the last 10,000 years, and they deny it. So building a boat that's going to blast seawater into the air and try and curb the solar rays is not exactly what's going to work. And it's not going to confound greenhouse gas heating of the globe, because that's not the cause of what we're seeing. We're seeing the Earth heat up because we're coming out of an ice age. We're coming out of a period, and Earth is simply getting back to normal. If you look at the age of the dinosaurs, the entire world was tropical. And of course, Earth could have been in a different orbit at that time, also due to the interaction of a comet. We don't have a good history, but as long as science continues to deny the interaction of Earth with large comets as the fundamental changing mechanism for Earth climate, Earth changes, mass extinctions, etc., as long as modern science denies that, sticks their head in the sand, and doesn't recognize this, they're going to keep coming up with all of these other mechanisms for trying to combat something. Greenhouse gases, it doesn't work on Venus, which has a tremendously thick, laden, what you would call greenhouse atmosphere, but that's not the cause of high heat on Venus. The greenhouse effect does not work on Venus, so how is it going to work on Earth? At any rate, enough of that. But let me switch now to, just another little announcement. I've been meaning to mention this on my show. A number of weeks ago, and I get a chance to interact with fans just by telephone calls. In this particular case, I was talking to a high school math teacher, and he was using my Calculate Primes book and teaching his high school students. I won't say where, because I'm afraid somebody would try and go after him or, you know, prevent him from teaching. But his students were using my book, Calculate Primes, to understand prime numbers. And, of course, this is something that should be happening all over the world, especially in the United States. But it's something that has been prevented. Anyway, that as the bizarre things unfold today, the events of today, isn't it bizarre that a new mathematical technique, the solution of the oldest problem in mathematics, to understand the patterns of the prime numbers, and that's what I did in that book release to the general public, was to solve the oldest problem in mathematics. Students are using that book to understand prime numbers. And the anecdote that I wanted to mention here is that he said that he had one young female student in his class who never really liked mathematics, did not do well in mathematics, all of a sudden really took a liking to the concept of prime numbers, started building tables and understanding and working with the prime numbers as it was presented in that book, and all of a sudden became very interested in mathematics. And so anyway, I just wanted to mention that's the kind of thing that makes me feel good. That there are people out there working, and that somewhere out there there's a student that picked up on what I did and is doing quite well. So, at any rate, I'm going to move to the main science topic. Luminescence. Okay, the concept of luminescence is when let's take a neon light bulb, for example. What's a neon light bulb? Well, first of all, you take a clear glass tube, you evacuate it, you take all the air out of it, and then you replace that with a rarefied gas of neon. And there's other types of gases you can use in these type of light bulbs, but neon seems to be the most popular. Okay, now you close the ends of the glass tube and you put an electrode, a metal electrode, into the glass. So now you take a high voltage source and you put it across that glass, across the ends of the tube, and all of a sudden you have the ability to drive electrical current through the gas. The gas becomes the conductor, and free electrons moving in that tube collide with the gas molecules. The electrons that are in the orbits of the atoms, in the neon atoms, are bumped up to a higher energy level, and then drop down into their normal base level energy state and give off light. Now, this is characteristic light of neon, as a particular color. If you and so basically, if you put any gas or any type of material in that tube and followed the same process, the luminescence, and that's what it is called, the correct scientific name for this process is called luminescence. Basically, you take a material and you bombard it with light, electrons, electrical current, some other form of energy. And now this is different. Okay, let's take another type of heat. It's called it would be like a black body heat light. If you took your iron or a piece of metal and you took a flame and you heated that metal up, and all of a sudden it starts glowing red or orange or blue if it gets really hot, that's a very different type of light. That's called heat light. That's a light that is characteristic of the temperature of the material. And it doesn't matter if you have steel or iron or some other material, the heat light is given off in what we call black body radiation or black body spectrum. And that is dependent on the temperature of that material. The luminosity, based on the original process where you take an electrical current or you shine a light on the gas, and then that gas gives off a characteristic line of light or a characteristic frequency of light based on that material, that is luminosity. Another application where luminosity is used is we all now have access to these amazing lights, LED lights. They're called LEDs. And so how do they work? You take typically a material of phosphorus and coat a diode, an LED, a little electrical diode, and the heat, the diode emits light, and it's absorbed by the phosphorus, which then re-emits energy at its characteristic frequency, which is typically white. And so it's a tremendously efficient a method for putting out light. A lot of people don't realize that when you are in your house and you have an incandescent light bulb, this is the old Edison light bulb, it has a little wire filament in there that heats up, and by heating it up hot enough and in vacuum so it doesn't oxidize, the light given off is a form of black body radiation. And so the white light is useful light. It's light that allows you to see in your house or to in your automobile to see the road. But along with that light is a tremendous amount of heat, just simple heat energy that's given off. In fact, only about 5% of the energy that goes into that light bulb in the form of electricity, only about 5% comes out in the form of light. All of the rest goes off in the form of heat. And so we're heating up, we're burning a tremendous amount of energy to give a little bit of light and then a tremendous amount of heat. So not only is the electrical distribution process very inefficient, getting from the power plant to your house, a lot of energy is lost just in that delivery process, but then you put it into a light bulb, and you only, even after that tremendous loss of getting the power to your house, only a very small amount goes into actual lighting. So the most efficient form of lighting to date is the LED diode lights, LED lighting. And when that came out, what should have happened immediately is everybody should have replaced their light bulbs, their incandescent light bulbs, with LED light bulbs. And the cost should have been, that's the kind of thing where government subsidies would have made a lot of sense. because eventually, once you buy those lights, they last forever. You don't have to replace them. They're very efficient. And I forget what the percentage is, about 20% of the energy in the United States goes into lighting. Just by converting to those light bulbs, we would save a ton of energy. At any rate, that's a good example of luminosities, or another very similar process is fluorescent. And so, anyway, the point is that comets, especially this comet right now that's going to be visible in late March, early April, and I'll be talking about where to look for this and what to look for. And by the way, I know a lot of people get feedback from my listeners. They're going out and buying binoculars, and it's a really good thing to do. You don't have to have huge binoculars. If you're not used to using binoculars and astronomical equipment, don't buy a set that's too big. I would say keep it under 5 pounds for your binoculars. And that's a pretty heavy set of binoculars, but buy an extra heavy tripod. But make sure you get your binoculars from a bona fide astronomical supplier of optical equipment. And I won't name any online because there's so many good ones out there. Yeah, but you can get them fairly inexpensive. But the thing about optical, constructing optical equipment for astronomy, is that the lenses are coated. Now, the lenses are ground in a machine to make the lenses, and then putting on a very fine coating of liquid gives you an absolute perfect lens shape. And so it makes your images much brighter, much clearer. It allows you to focus better. And so there's many, many reasons, especially when you're looking at something as faint as a comet. But right now we have 3 comets coming into the solar system that are going to grace our skies in the next year. The first one we're going to see is the comet C2012F6. And this is the one that's lighting up like a neon light bulb. And this is what I started to say earlier in the show, that originally they gave the concept that this was due to the reflection of light. And I know these people listen to my show, and I just slammed that about as well as it could get slammed. So I noticed they're not using that terminology anymore. They're kind of just hand-waving it and saying this light is due to a couple gases found in the comet tail. But they're not talking about luminosity, because a dirty snowball doesn't have any electrons moving through it. It doesn't have any other source of light or energy except the light of the sun. And so that's not enough to cause luminosity. And there's not enough energy there to cause reflected light so that we could see it. And third, if you really take good equipment, astronomical equipment with spectroscopic equipment attached, you would easily measure the fact that these comets are luminescing. In other words, it's the line spectrum of these atoms and molecules in the tail of the comet, which are producing the light. So this is not a hard thing to do. The other thing that they sure do not want anybody talking about is that those spectral lines are redshifted. So when you take your good spectroscopic equipment, you train it on a highly charged electrical comet, like comet C2012F6 Lemon, what I'm talking about. And by the way, that will be visible in the northern hemisphere, the United States, Europe, Russia, etc. It'll be visible in the northern hemisphere late March and through April. So we'll get to see a real good example of, and that at that point it'll be naked eye visible, but binoculars make it a whole lot better. So like I said, make sure you got your binoculars astronomical grade, a good heavy tripod, and some warm clothes, because you want to stay out there for a while. And you got to get away from the city lights. You got to find a place where you can go. It's nice and dark, and wait for the weather report when you know it's going to be really clear and dark, and go out there. The southwestern U.S. deserts are pristine and wonderful for this. So if you happen to be going on vacation down to the American Southwest, make sure you take your binoculars and viewing equipment with you. But at any rate, if even amateurs, and I know that I know people who have spectroscopic equipment, if you train your telescope with your spectral analysis equipment attached, and you look for those lines. Now they're saying cyanide and carbon monoxide, but I would like to verify that because I'd like to see if that's really the colors we're seeing here. But you could analyze the spectrum coming off of this comet, and not only are you going to see the spectrum of certain chemicals that are in that comet tail, but you're going to see that those lines are redshifted. In other words, they're not going to appear at exactly the correct frequencies on your spectrometer. They are going to appear to with a lower frequency, longer wavelength, and in other words, redshifted. And the reason for that is because the comet nucleus, the light is coming from the region around the comet nucleus that is electrically charged. It's a non-uniform electric field, a fairly significant one. And I want to mention that in the 1986 era, when Comet Halley came through the solar system, I happened to be in contact with some astronomers who went to South America with some good spectroscopic equipment, and they were going to take the spectrum of Comet Halley. They did. They got the data, and it was redshifted. They never published the data. They didn't want to become the laughingstock of the astronomical community, who would have probably blackballed them and ruined their careers, so they just never published the data. This is the way science works today in the good old US of A. If the science don't fit, if the scientific data doesn't fit the established theories, don't publish it, because you might not be around tomorrow. That's just the way it works. So, but anyway, I'll be working more on this, trying to get some good data with spectroscopic data for this comet. First of all, to really see what the elements are that are the luminosity, the actual spectrum of these chemicals in the tail, and then also to look for the spectral lines to be redshifted. So once again, the entire concept of luminosity, let's look at some other comets that were highly luminous. Hayakutake was a small comet, but it came real close to Earth, so it was very visible. I believe Comet West back in the 1960s was very visible. And let me see. Comet Hale-Bopp was a comet that was very luminous, but most of us saw it as a white comet up in the sky because it had a very big dust tail. It was a dust tail that was very extensive, and it could be seen up in the morning sky. By the way, I did not mention, last week or 2 weeks ago, I forget now. My life is so busy. There are so many things going on in my brain these days that I forget times and places. But my show ended a little abruptly one night, and I think it was 2 weeks ago. The building I was in started to shake, and there was an earthquake where I was, and but at any rate, that caused me to cut the show a little bit short. I wanted to get out of the building, which I did. And at first I thought it was just me. Then I looked up and I saw the curtains moving. And then I went out and everybody else was talking about the earthquake. But at any rate, a little bit of excitement there. once down in the Caribbean, especially some of the Caribbean islands will move many times per day. That's one of the characteristics. And there's many other places in the world that have very frequent but small earthquakes, like one or two on the Richter scale. But when things start moving, it's like the earth is moving beneath me. There's not a lot you can do about it. Okay, back to the topic of luminosity. We have comets that are now coming into the solar system, and I think that the comet that we're going to see this coming fall, C2012S1, is going to be a comet that will be highly luminous. And that's why already NASA and the standard science community, the government mouthpieces, internet pages, etc., are already gearing up, because they know this baby is going to be lighting up like a light bulb. It's going to be visible according to predictions, not my predictions, but according to standard science predictions, will be visible in daylight, in broad daylight. And you know how the moon, if the moon is up in the daytime, you can see the moon, but this will be 4 to 5 times brighter than the full moon and big. It'll stretch across the sky. So at any rate, that's coming up this year, and I think it's going to be a luminous comet, so get prepared. And that's something that I'll be working on to get the correct equipment. And by the way, I'm now working on all of the data that will be on my webpage. It'll be updated regularly, but the viewing times, the viewing locations, etc., for the three comets, there's three now, especially the comet C2012S1, I'll be giving that data on my webpage, so something I'll be working on. Okay, back to just to remind you, go to the webpage jmccsci.com, short for jmccsci.com, jmccsci.com, and all of the information about the new ebook is there. It's something that I know everybody is going to want. And there are two ways to purchase it: $12 for the ebook itself, if you already have my other books. If you don't have my other books, you really need to read the other 5 books to put this one into perspective. You could read the book all by itself and then go back and read the other books later. But you can get the new book for free if you order the 5-book set of ebooks, the 5 books that are already out there in existence. And like I said, if you order the book, then about an hour before the release program, you will get an email which will tell you where to go and download that. So I'll be announcing that release show very shortly. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.